Thanks, everybody. Well, welcome to the Game Only Podcast. Damien, it's so good to see you.
Oh,
I feel like a huge weight is lifted off my shoulder this morning.
I know. Congratulations. You finished your talk.
Thanks, man.
We have partner Andreas here as well.
Yeah.
Congratulations, fellas.
Well, all the credit goes to Andreas. He spent so much time on making that a slick presentation.
Yeah, visually. But lots of credit goes to Anton for actually thinking about what the topic of the talk is really about.
Yeah. Well, the rapport again was, it had a great degree of comfortability, and you guys were super natural and actually super comedic. There was a lot of, anyway, you communicated it really well.
Cool, thanks. So what else have we got here on the table? It's a crowd.
It's a big one already, and it's going to get bigger. So let's go around really quickly, say your name, and briefly what you do.
All right. My name is David Fall. I'm an audio programmer, and I'm here because I want to push the future of game audio. I want to be a part of a group of people with getting amazing feedback and kind of exploring where we can go next. So that's really my aim in life, and I'm glad to be here.
Cool. Thanks for coming, David.
Come join us.
My name is Andreas Wager. I've worked with Anton at Guerrilla for almost six or 7 years now. And I have to stand all of his bullshit, so...
Thanks, Andreas.
I'm RJ Mattingly. I'm a sound designer working on a contract with Microsoft.
I'm Andy Martin. I'm a sound designer at Sucker Punch Productions. And I'm here because it's my one time every year that I can see people I went to school with and really like but never see anywhere else.
I'm Bob Affey. I'm a sound designer and composer. I'm here to intimidate my clients today.
I'm Kelly Pico. I'm a freelance contract sound designer. His muscle pretty much, Bob's muscle to get people to pay him.
I'm Funwell Dio, and I'm a composer for film and video games, and just hanging out with friends.
Cool. And I'm Chris Trevino. I'm a sound recordist and sound designer. And right now living in Japan working on this custom sound pixel library there in the Marine Corps.
Jared Selter, sound designer, composer, musician.
Brad, audio QA at FIFA, and freelance sound designer.
Alex Albo, sound design, educating myself.
Cool. Well, you guys have been with us pretty much every day this week so far. Congrats on that.
10%.
I'm Ryan, and I'm a freelance composer for indie games.
Jam.
Well, lots of composers on the table today, too.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. Nice to musician friends are here.
Yeah. That is cool. So yesterday was the first day of the expo, the first day of sessions outside of the audio boot camp, and sessions across all the disciplines. So what happened yesterday? What did people do? What did they see? What was inspiring? Give us a little high-level snippet of something that was awesome yesterday.
There's this weird talk from these guys at Guerrilla. it was okay, but you know, actually I wanted to say, both of you two, that it was one of the best talks I've been to in a long time.
Oh, wow.
I would have happily gone to two talks from the guys, one that was about the tool set that you created, and another one that would be about the importance and necessity of collaboration and integration with the rest of the team, because I think what you illustrated, there was something that gets missed at a lot of places, where sound is this thing that goes off in the corner and everyone just sort of hopes that they don't kill the sound people.
Yeah.
And you guys displayed a level of community that it makes it look like...
I think Rob Bridget is going to do a talk on collaboration today, I believe, right?
Yeah.
I think, and he also did one about that, I think, on the bootcamp day.
Yes, small team game development.
Yeah. I think you definitely have to catch that one from Rob Bridget.
Yeah. I agree. Totally embodied that. You guys rocked it. I went to a session that was... wait a second. I was on a panel in a session. How's that? That was fun. It was an interactive game audio demo group. And it was the first time that they've had it. And people brought their games that they had redesigned the sound for and put them up on the screen. And someone drove around in them and did the things, and then a panel of people, you know, made suggestions. And I guess I wanted to bring it up because I think, first of all, it's significant because it focused mostly on the interactive aspect of game audio, which is new this year. To me, that shows this rising tide of the importance of implementation. So that was kind of cool. And second, it was great to see new ideas coming up from people who are not necessarily in games yet, but they're working their way in. And seeing that process, I feel like, was really valuable to me, because I think it keeps it in perspective that we were all finding our way in at some point. And
so, does anybody attend that session there? So, did you get anything out of that? Because you were on the panel side, right?
Sure,
so
sure.
I submitted a linear piece because I was under a time crunch, so I didn't know about the interactive
right away.
It was super valuable, and I think one of the things I enjoyed most was afterwards, later in the night, I was actually able to talk to each one of the panelists and get even more customer feedback and more support for it.
Wow.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah. And how about seeing some of the interactive stuff? Did you feel like the presentation of that helped bridge the gap between your knowledge of what implementation is and, like, maybe some of the things that that go into that? I mean, was there a side of that was learning as well?
Yeah, there definitely was. Seeing how other people took the challenge and were able to fill out, or not quite fill out, the sound space well enough really gave me ideas of how I would do it myself.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, again, things like, things that came up
so
over and over.
I thought I would be the first. Oh, no, there I go.
Yep, there it was. Things that came up over and over again were, attenuation curves that were not quite big enough for these giant robots, or ambient backgrounds that didn't blend between environments appropriately, mix that was off, or looping weapon sounds that didn't quite commit to their intention, I guess. And so it was interesting to see those things kind of come up over and over again, not necessarily in all of the projects, but these are some of the details of the technical side of integration, which I feel like it was great to be able to have a conversation about, the importance of those things as it relates to the technical aspect of sound design and communicating the intention of the content that people create.
Yeah.
Because I think it's been a dark art and a gray area, and it was great to have the opportunity to spin that a bit.
So I missed it, because I think that was at the same time that the Tomb Raider talk was, if I'm not mistaken. And that was really cool as well. They gave an overview of the tech that they were using, which was a lot. But then there was also a long part about the music of the game. And he really gave some excellent examples of how he went through a particular section of the game. They made some amazing custom instruments for it as well. But he was Alex.
Alex Wilmer, yeah.
Alex Wilmer. And he was also really good about showing the same section of the game a couple of times and then going into different elements of it, because if you hear something once and it's a complicated scene like Tomb Raider, which has got so much going on, and it's very difficult to miss certain bits, right? Were you talking about all that stuff and now I have to hear all of that at once? You don't have that. But instead he took like one part of the score and demonstrated that, and then took another part of the score and demonstrated that. So I thought it was really cool. Did anybody else see that session?
Yeah.
What do you think of it, Brad?
Any other takeaways from it? Yeah.
It was really interesting to see his process, and he was able to show a lot about the way that the music was composed and sort of the process that went through.
Yeah. And that's Alex is a. What did we call him last night?
Oh, I made a new term for him. He called himself music supervisor.
Yeah.
And to me, music supervisor is a management title. Like, you're somebody that makes sure that the composer knows what he's doing and he's got all the information and stuff, et cetera.
Yeah.
And it somehow ends up in the game. But what he described in the talk was much more creative. He was really involved with how the score worked. And that reminded me of you, of course. So I
and
coined
you,
the term.
Of course.
Yeah, and myself. But you know, it reminded me, and so then it was very easy to jump to technical composer.
Sure.
Yeah. So he's the lead technical composer on Tomb Raider, as far as I'm concerned.
I think we just defined a new specialization in game.
I call his boss and get him a new contract. You know, so.
Yeah, nice. More money for sure.
Yeah, that sounds much more important.
Oh, totally. Yeah, worth it.
It was also interesting to see how we work with Jason Graves. It's sort of a unique relationship you don't see, but there's a lot of back and forth. He was sort of more doing the implementation, where Jason Graves was composing.
Exactly, and because they had such a good rapport and they trusted each other, that meant, you know, it must be really scary for a composer to hand that kind of thing off to somebody else, because, you know, here's your darling, and now somebody can just destroy it if they don't know what they're doing. But if you got a really good relationship like that, you know, you can do so much more.
Yeah. It's that trust thing. Mm. For sure, for sure. Who went to the Killer Instinct talk?
Yeah.
Okay, that was a lot. Andy?
Well, I was actually gonna say I went to a whole other talk before that. Actually, RJ and I were there, and I've been telling people about it all day. So, almost really ironically, at the same time as the Tomb Raider talk, exactly one floor down was a non-audio talk that was about misogyny and racism and homophobia and every other ism and phobia that you can think of in video games.
Was that Man v. Air?
Yes, it was. And excellent. it was an excellent and powerful and really aggravating at the same time talk. Because he did a really good breakdown of all these negative tropes and stereotypes that are used in games and how they hurt us and players, and you know, and a really good breakdown of all the arguments that people try to use to suggest that they have to do it, or you know, that it's something that, you know, they do it because that's what players want. And I was so impressed with the talk that I've been telling people about it. Like, if you have vault access, when the vault opens, you have to listen to it and go see it.
Yeah, and it was really awesome how, you know, with talks of that type that are, you know, kind of delicate, it's very easy to just say, this is what's wrong with the industry, this is what's wrong with games that we're making, you know, and not throw out any solutions. But he proposed a bunch of, like, really, really clever ideas that I had never thought of. You know, I mean, for you know, one of the examples that he gave was, you know, incorporating game, you know, these concepts, you know, that are delicate into actual, like, game mechanics. Like what if the player has to be like a squadron leader who is, you know, gay, and you know you're the game mechanic is you're trying to hide that from, you know, the people that you're serving with, and or you come out in front of them and you see their reaction or something, and like,
how does it affect your ability to lead?
Exactly,
and
you know, like see people
follow.
Not actually following you anymore, or
being the converse of that, or you know, just like letting the player actually experience some of the repercussions of all of this stuff. Really kind of like a fascinating idea.
It is definitely, but I just can't see having the next Call of Duty. Just seems so unlikely that this is actually going to happen.
It's true.
And then that's actually where it matters, right? It's where the mass audience is.
And the thing that he was saying is it's really hard. It's going to be really hard to, like, incite this change, just because, you know, everybody on the marketing teams always kind of have this, like, self-fulfilled prophecy that, you know, those types of games aren't going to sell as well. You know, if it's not, like, a strong, heroic male character leading the game, then it's not going to sell. But really, the games that don't do that are in such small numbers that it's very easy to say those are unsuccessful. They don't get nearly as much production money to make, you know,
right,
a big, giant game.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, really the change is not... The best way to prove that it works is it has some big company or some big project to just decide to do it, have it work, and then...
Yeah. Well, and Manveer has been a tireless advocate in that area. He used to work at a company in near where I live in was, so I live in Minneapolis, but he worked at a company called Raven, which is next door in Wisconsin. And he gave a talk at an IGDA meetup that they had there. And, you know, this is kind of something that he is famous for and has, you know, spent a lot of time thinking about. But he gave, you know, he is one of the people who are actively working to provide these kind of solutions. And, you know, last year there was some drama about gender equality, and I think that we're starting to see more of that conversation happening in the public space around video games. You have the Anita Sarkeesian's Women in Tropes in Video Games series, which is, you know, extremely eye-opening if you take a chance to dig into how women have been represented in games across, you know, our lifetimes, I guess. And I think it's great to have those kind of discussions right now.
The topic, if you saw her yesterday, she won the award.
Oh, did she?
Yes.
Tell me.
Yes. It was awesome, right? She was one of the two people during the award show that got standing ovations.
Oh, excellent.
Her and Ken Kutaragi, who won the Lifetime Achievement Award. But I already heard that she got a shit ton of stuff happening again on the internet.
Oh, so yeah.
The same thing happened again. And it's a shame.
Sure, and that circles around to another thing that's been hot lately is toxicity in the online community, you know, and the idea that, you know, you shouldn't have to bear the brunt of an attack because of what you're passionate about and how and what you're trying to bring across, right? I think, you know, unrelated to her experience and maybe outside of this discussion was the whole Flappy Bird, you know, thing that exploded, right? Where the developer all of a sudden, quote unquote, you know, had this runaway success that people either loved or hated or, you know, were just very outspoken to him about their feelings. And after a while, there was kind of a mounting rage or anger towards him to the point where he felt like he had to take the game off the App Store. It's no longer available. And he's like, you know what? I just can't handle the emotion of this interaction with the community that feels like they have the right to be so...
to me, it's also passionate. That kind of thing, though. We had a really practical thing a couple years ago in the Netherlands where some poor girl made a Facebook post about a party, and there was a movie about this as well, I think, at some point. And then about before that, and that you would go to this girl's party with a 10,000 people, and your party crashed, right? Did something ridiculous. And what happened in the Netherlands at that point was that the media picked up on it being a small, like, little hype on the internet. You know, a couple thousand people on Facebook were saying they were going to come. Some radio show picked up on that, put it on the air, 50 million people, well, there was like 3 million people listening to that show, and then suddenly it became a huge thing, right? Then other media pick it up and it becomes huge. So I think, and with these kind of things, I'm not blaming the media for that, but they do have a responsibility in, you know, accelerating that kind of thing. And especially with the Flappy Bird thing as well, if it was just the community doing that, I mean, it wouldn't have been such a big thing. If people weren't getting attention for being such drama queen assholes, then, you know, they wouldn't do it anymore. We're always feeding the trolls, right? And so who is really the troll there? Well, I don't know.
It was really cool with the Flappy Bird performance that right before that, it had been at Candy Crush Saga Spectacle. So basically right before the Flappy Bird, they said, you can't trademark a name. And then right after it, you can't use pipes that were in the game.
Yeah,
I find it was kind of funny that they're complaining about totally different things.
But, you know, people are crazy, but, you know, we should be able to ignore it or at least not pay too much attention to the kind of ridiculousness that if you see somebody in the street walking around saying what those people say, right, you would think, oh, that's a poor guy who's a bit disturbed and maybe give him some money, you know, if you have it, and a smoke. But you're not going to sit down and write an article about it in the Washington Post, right? So, I don't know, it's on Twitter, so it's news. It's ridiculous.
Sure. The best outcome is this conversation here at the table today and at GDC and in the community at large. I'm really glad you brought it up because I feel like it's, again, maybe it does escalate it. Maybe it does give attention. Maybe it does shine a light. but I feel like it's through that that we can then have this conversation and discuss the merit and or not.
Yeah. It's sort of like the first step in recovering from alcohol addiction or drugs is admitting that you have a problem with alcohol or drugs.
Right.
Until you can admit it, until you can talk about it, just going to stay there and get worse.
I was going to say, I think that like when you brought it up as this self-fulfilling prophecy in a lot of big game studios where you're kind of normalizing toward the thing that that you think your market is or you expect your market to be. And this is, you know, this is not something that's only isolated to video games. This is something that happens every day in Hollywood.
Happens every day in life.
Yeah, it does. But I mean, talking just specifically about like media, interactive media, I think it shines a light in video games, especially because video games are just starting to birth into something that is on par with or competitive with Hollywood filmmaking. And now those cliches and those stereotypes, which are very obvious to a lot of us, we don't think about them because we have so many more complicated audio problems to solve and other things that we're thinking about, storytelling and all this stuff. We don't really think about that. But I think in games it's more magnetized because we haven't had the scrutiny and the exposure that Hollywood's had since like the early 1930s. Video games are a lot younger than that. But I think that those same questions are going to need to be answered, or new solutions are going to need to be found moving forward, because this can't stay this way forever.
Yeah, and it, you know, the kind of tail off of that, you know, in film. And you know, in Hollywood productions, movie and TV productions, you know, they're hiring actors to portray these parts. In video games, you know, we're creating them from the ground up. You know, these are pixelized people that don't exist in the real world that we're assembling. And to see a screen to see a slide in that had, it was like 4x4, I think it was, of the white male hero. That was Nathan Drake in the middle, and then everyone who looks like Nathan Drake all around him, you know, is the kind of thing that makes you think, you know, if we're making them from the ground up, if we're making them to bring them to life, there's no reason whatsoever that they need to look alike. No. You know?
But they do.
But they do.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And that's the problem.
I'll say, as far as talking about the stereotypes that you see in games, as a parent, I've got a 9-year-old boy. And right now we are just knee-deep in Mass Effect, and there are these little things, which I'm realizing some of these pieces of media, some of these games really have the power to shape the next generation and their politics and stuff. Going through and playing the story mode in Mass Effect, watching my son and getting to the point where one of the soldiers talks about losing his husband in the war, and it did not faze my son at all, but it was the first time personally that I experienced that deep. That sort of nonchalant, like no big deal in real life, that's how it would be now.
Right.
And here it is, and my son is playing and we're experiencing this together. And it's awesome because it's one of those parts of media that is really powerful. Film is a powerful media as well, but being interactive like that, and you know, you got headphones on and you're focused in on this, it has the power to do that. And it inspired me, just you know, with this 9-year-old kid to be watching him play this game and see that the power that those games, the stories in those games actually have to help kind of shape the next generation and what they think and politics. So much of the games can actually be communicated through the format itself.
Right.
Politics, so much of it. It's
so. I think like Mass Effect is a great example of how it's done right. Right. So to end on that, on this subject, sync dance time. Thank you.
Oh.
That's gonna make my life easier.
So who went to the Killer Instinct talk now?
I did.
Okay, a lot of people went to that.
Mick, man. Wow.
Pow!
But also Jed, wow.
My chest kept going.
I know.
I didn't go, so
man,
tell me.
The presentation was really great. It was kind of this Penn and Teller kind of experience. I kind of felt like they were just working off of each other, you know. it was really kind of an interactive thing. You know, there were a lot of questions to the audience, a lot of direct questions to individuals, like what does music mean to you?
Sure.
You know, some of the answers were similar. People said it was emotional. I think that they were really focusing on music is a story. It's telling a story. It's narrative.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I always say it's like if you turn the music off in anything and you stare at it long enough, you're like, wow, this really doesn't have the same meaning. Music is telling the story because it's providing the archetype, but it's also providing the time. You know, it's telling you before something happens or showing you what happens after something. So it expands what you see in the frame to across time, you know. And that was really good. And, you know, there was a lot of talk about that, and that was fascinating. And then, of course, the technical aspects of how they did their music composition, the tools that they used, the beat syncing and the timing and the crossfades. I think it was really a good example of that kind of stuff. But yeah, I think it was a really useful talk.
One thing I really liked they did in the presentation was, rather than just say, oh yeah, this is how we did it, and then give an example of what they did, they gave an example of how it worked throughout the game. And so there was like the ultra final, the ultra final combo, that each character has this melody that they play when they do the combo. Rhythm may be slightly different, and the sounds are different because they're on a different level and it's using different music cues, but because it has the same mechanic built in, it's the same melody every time. And so he played an example from every single level so that you had the opportunity to see how it stays the same and yet changes as it progresses.
Yeah, that example was really good.
Yeah. I thought it was really cool that they did it all with off-the-shelf tools. I mean, it was just Wise's music system.
Right.
And, you know, I went in there thinking, oh, they must have done something special here, or it was kind of crazy programming or implementing that they have going on, and then I was just like, oh, this is Wise. That's cool.
It was also cool to see Jed go into some of his sound design work, especially when how he sourced the material.
Yeah.
I still wish though that the sound systems and the rooms themselves at Moscone were more conducive to actually hearing what people's work is about, because for example with the examples they gave of the impacts, they sounded exactly the same every time. Yeah. But it's obviously not the sounds that they made, it's obviously just the room response that you're listening to.
Yes. This is one of the things that needs to change, right? I mean, it's surprising that we have these spaces, but sonically we don't have any way to really reproduce. Like what you're talking, you're like, there's stuff that's happening behind you, but you're gonna hear it out of the speaker that you're nearest, and it's gonna sound very muffled.
Yeah, we had a slight technical problem setting up the surround for iTalk. Okay. So that was kind of annoying, actually, because it wasn't anybody's fault there or ours, but for some reason, the center channel and the rear surround channels did not play. So they didn't have audio, but they were coming out of our system and they were being heard by the surround amp. They were just being heard from the speakers, but we went through the whole thing for about an hour, frantically trying to fix it. But it's also kind of shows still in 2014,
right.
You know, even though for most of this stuff right now, setting up a surround system is super easy, but still in 2014, you can go and sit down and have these major issues with something like a six channel setup, which, you know,
it's still a bad cable.
Yeah, exactly. And this is with a group full of audio professionals, you know, and then that felt really bad, to be honest. It really is something that not something on this day, it's not anybody on this table can fix, but it's somebody, you know, somebody at hardware manufacturers need to figure out ways to do this.
Amps have too many options.
Too many ways to bring
and complicated menus that you have to navigate through, and it's way.
I would argue that the televisions are like that too. You just want to get the picture right. It could be pretty complicated.
I don't really. If I have to buy a new TV, I'm looking for something that doesn't have any power yet.
You just power button and channels.
HDMI in and turn it on. I get my TV from an external box anyway.
Yeah.
Right, to the TV, all the stuff that the TV has that I don't really care about.
Right.
It's just a dumb screen.
Yes.
Should be just a dumb screen.
But we were talking about the Killer Instinct, so I don't want to say. We have some composers here as well. What was your perspective on the talk? Did you go to that talk?
Yeah.
I really liked how they that the storytelling aspect. It was interesting to see that in a fighting game context. And I think that they did a great job of building this arc within those battles. Like, it really felt like the music is telling the story and also giving feedback to the player, which is it's great to have the music take part in that. So it's not just a track playing in the background, but really once you're playing, you feel the music change and feel like you know how you're doing. That's great.
What another thing that I really liked from what Mick pointed out, he made a big show out of it because and that kind of almost made me miss the point. But there was a part where he wanted to have a piece with a beat, and then sometimes he didn't want to have that beat play. So the trick he used was using reductive composition. So instead of making another music track and having it without that beat, he just took that track with just a beat, phase flipped it, and then played it over that track. So from whenever you know he wanted that particular moment to not have that beat, it would just cut out with that track. And you know that's a terrific way of you know taking a system that you have and really getting everything out of it. You know that's where you reach. That's when you know you're pushing that system to its limits when you're finding creative solutions like that. You know that's then, because of course. It's very easy to think there, well, I just need another track. You know, add a couple more tracks, give me more memory for music because I want to have another one without this beat, right? But then if you have the wits to come up with a solution like that, somebody like Andreas or the tech coders on your team are really going to like you because you're freeing up space for the other parts of the game, you know?
It's always nice to be able to work within constraints because it forces you to be creative in new ways.
If you're smart enough about it, that you can actually come up with a solution like that. And the funny thing about it too is that all of these things are not new tricks. Face flipping something to take something out is probably the oldest trick in the book. You know, you could already do that in the analog days, and they were doing that in the analog days. But it was a really good example of a trick that I would think about at home and also use. So definitely a note that I took away.
I really liked on the sound design side, you know, just the little snapshots that he took of, like, or videos that he took of the recording process. It was like, it's very cool, you know, to see such a great sounding game using such really simple sound effect recording methods. You know, I mean, he's like pulling a roll of duct tape in the company kitchen, right? You know?
Yeah, it was so funny because we did exactly the same thing for Killzone as well, and it just works really, really well.
Yeah,
it's an awesome trick. We went to this really cool recording studio in London called Hackenbecker, and amazing place. Well, one little side note about Hackenbecker, custom built building where they dug, they basically dug a swimming pool in the ground and filled it with concrete. So when you do Foley there, you don't have the octave underneath resonance that you have when you walk there. So talk about people that are like investing in the future.
Well, I guess that's kind of my point is almost the opposite was just that like the idea that when you're like making a AAA game, you know, you don't need to go into this like crazy studio to get like good sounding recordings. You know, I mean, he's in like those raw recordings were really, they were recorded in a kitchen, you know, they sounded mediocre, but like the stuff that he actually got out of it was awesome.
Yeah. And it's those kinds of raw recordings are what makes me want to be a sound designer. Like the more low tech I can go and the more I can break things, the more I feel like I'm doing a good job.
But one little point about that as well is like the reason we went to Hackenbecker was not this concrete floor underneath, but because the Nigel there is such an amazing sound designer that has everything there and he knows how to make these sounds, so you go there for that experience of knowing what to do there. But I'm totally with you that, because another example, like the guys for Tomb Raider made all of those instruments with the metal bits and everything, and it looked really nice. But I have my dog crate, right? It's a wire cage for the dog that he goes into if we travel or something, right? If you take a bow and mic up a contact microphone on that and string that and bow that thing, it also sounds, it's not the same, but it also sounds amazing, right? So you're in the same territory of metal sounds. So I think every sound designer should have a bow, a double bass bow. Like
I went through 3 cello bows a couple of years ago, and then I found you can get 3 stringable bows. It was life changing. Because now I could feel totally free to just destroy the hair on anything that I wanted to resonate, you just go pay $5 and get more hair.
I watch the sales that happen at the orchestra stores in town. When there's a big sale, I go buy another bow.
Why? Oh, yeah.
Because they're always on sale, and it's like, oh, sure, I'll grab that one.
Cool. So show of hands, who has a bow at home? Oh, yeah, that's way more than I thought. Cool.
How many show of hands, who uses it to play a string instrument?
No way. Oh, you play a string instrument, David?
No, my daughter does that.
Oh.
Can I piggyback on her?
Wait, so are you taking a bow and just destroying it on metal objects and then returning it in a case?
And she thought it was
like he's a virtuoso cellist. You didn't know that?
Oh.
I play a saw, so that's sort of an instrument.
Oh, boy.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Let's call it a bit socially acceptable.
Yeah.
You guys find sound design for games. In the film world, when I do stuff, if someone breaks a window, I try to find a piece of glass and break it. I always have options in my sound library to do other stuff. You guys are talking about recording tape and doing all this stuff for sound design. For those same, for games, when there is an incident, like a window break, do you guys find yourself going into libraries more to find that stuff and put that in and spending the time recording on some of the more sort of, is it more of the sound design stuff that don't have sounds that you're recording for and all the other incidental stuff you are finding stuff for and putting it in?
I find it to be more an issue of how much time I have.
Yeah.
If I'm really, really pressed for time, I troll my library first, and if I don't have anything, then I'll troll some sound effects libraries. If I have time, then I'll do exactly that. I'll go out and... This is why I need time. I'll go out and find like 500 different windows.
I think I was going to say the scale is different, right? You're making, you're doing a linear piece, and there's the scene where they break the window, okay? But I think in games it's going to be like, you have a game, and in the game you can break windows, plural. And so you have to, you can't just take that one pane of glass. You got to be calculated with that, and if you're going to be breaking windows all the time in the game, because every window they put
breaking
in is
windows
dynamic.
Windows epic saga.
That's right.
Yeah. Oh, there you go.
Oh, yeah, but the balls. Yeah.
Oh,
that
cool.
is a great game.
But I would say, like in general, right? You would generally try to get consistency for multiple variations. And from library stuff, it's usually very difficult because in libraries usually you want to have five different ones that sound quite different, you know. So in most libraries available right now, they're not really suited to create physics sounds, really. So all of that stuff is generally something, and because you can actually anticipate physics sounds very, very well in advance, it's usually one of the things you start first in production, because you know it's going to be in all of the game, and you're also not going to be, it's going to have to work on multiple window sizes anyways, right? You're going to have to compromise on the sound as it is. So it's one of the few things where you can go and do it a year or two in a major project, of course, depending on the size. You can do it at the start of the... I shouldn't say numbers like that. It makes me feel like an asshole because that's so... but, you know, it's...
You've got that much time.
Yeah, exactly. And you're still scrambling at the end? You must be really lazy at the start. But, you know, getting the variations right, that's definitely key. Yeah.
I actually find I do the same. If I've got a lot of time, I'll record it myself. If I've got a neat amount of time, I'll dig into the library. But then it rolls back to if I've got a really short amount of time, a lot of times I'll record it myself. It's actually quicker to go to the like dollar store, grab some stuff, and do it than it is to like search through the library and build something and make it work. But it's easier just to like, I know what I want and I can make it like,
yeah.
Like I had some hand-grabbing stuff in Marco Vigil. Nothing in the library fit what I needed for hands grabbing these things. So, and you speak of quality, like doing it in the kitchen. I went out back of our office in noisy downtown Vancouver and grabbed a bunch of pipes. It was by itself sounded horrible, but took it. What a horrible recorder too. And it's in the game. You don't notice that it linear sounds like crap. You know, in the game.
Hold on.
Yeah, and it worked. And it was like I had it when I needed it, really quickly, and it was a game of work.
Okay. the Rob Hamilton talk. I'd like to hear about it if you have something to share.
Yeah, that was very interesting. They had built this like small 3D world in Unreal, and they had modified the engine a little. They had it sending OSC, which is I think Open Sound Control. This is like generic music information that goes over UDP, and they had added that to it, and they were sending data to Super Collider, which is this kind of synthesizer application, and it was just that the information from the game world was modifying what it was playing. So they had, for example, they had this bird that was like the main character that was flying around. So they had connected the location of the bones and the wings to oscillators and had those modifying the pitch, and so you could actually go in a mode where you move the wings manually with the thumbsticks, and you can sort of play a melody with that. And this is really interesting, this kind of using game data to drive music directly on like micro level.
It's like a super low level version of Max MSP, right?
So
So you basically got like really, really low level control over the synthesizer. And so they can attach all the game, like all the game elements, all the what we would call the real-time parameter controls to like oscillators in a filter in an oscillator bank, or filters in a filter bank, and do more of like synthetic morphing and that kind of stuff, more additive synthesis and stuff like that, which is what they were showing off. So that was kind of cool.
It sounds super cool. And again, I think what it is it's right at the edge of the pure dynamism of games.
Where there
is all this information, there is all this simulation data, there are all these parameters, and in games I feel like we not often enough harness those in order to modify appropriately the sound that's being output.
Yeah, right? I want to say something about that, because that's actually, I think, a really interesting topic. When I was doing audio programming for many years over at Insomniac Games, one of the things that I was trying to do was work with our physics programmer, or work with our lighting programmer, and try to actually share that information. And we never got to the point where we could actually do that in a way that was cohesive and usable. And it was shunned upon a lot of the time.
Sure.
It was like, well, what we're doing, with light rendering is happening in the frame. It's not propagating over time. It's not a temporal problem. It's a spatial problem. Or, what we're doing with physics is too high frequency and too low level for dealing with sound diffraction and propagation in space and radiation patterns and stuff. So we didn't really get to the point where we could have that crossover, but I feel like that, like what you said, there's so much information that's already there, and we just need to tap into it, and that hasn't happened yet. I think that is the next generation, I really do.
I've had that discussion a lot with programmers who are not audio programmers, because I'm not a programmer myself. And I will approach them with that same sort of thing. Like, you've already got that information. You know when the impact's happening. You know what it's touching. You know how long and where it's going. And, can I just have some of that?
Exactly.
So I can work with it. And the response is very much the same. Oh, it's not what you need. Oh, it's different. And all I want to say is, give it to me anyway.
Yeah,
I can translate it.
Here's the thing, though. It's really not that easy. I mean, I do a lot of DSP, and I actually had like 4 major gatherings with this get-togethers with our programmer that was doing the water simulation in the game, and he was doing wave propagation. That's how he was doing the simulation, and it was beautiful. And I spent 4 meetings with him, 2 hours each, to try to figure out if I could extract some of that signal processing and apply it in the sound world. I really wanted to try. And we got to 4 meetings, and we hadn't made much progress. Now, could we have gotten there? Yeah, we probably would have had to have a lot more meetings. But it's not easy. It's not going to be an easy thing. But once it happens, it's there. It's kind of like what you guys did.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I kind of want to tap into.
before you basically what I've said is like for this to happen, it's all about communication, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You really have to talk to each other. It's so easy to have people in different areas in an office sitting there. They never meet, they never talk about this kind of things, right?
Mm-hmm. Otherwise, if they're across the office,
then these things can't even start to happen.
Mm-hmm. And, the other thing about it is, let's continue that thought in a second, is for me, right, in general, I talk a lot to Andreas and also talk to other departments in the code, right, to get different information. And what that leads to is the more I collaborate with other programmers as well, the more they trust me that the information that they're going to give me, I'm going to use in something that either is worthwhile or at least doesn't break the game, you know, and they're not wasting their time. And you need to win that battle for each different department every time.
Yeah.
But as soon as you've opened that gate, you know, and you should start with something small.
Yeah.
You know, for example, on the project, last project, I started to talk to AI guys because I think AI and sound really have a big future ahead of them as well, in for years and years to come, right? Because we're actually trying to do almost the same thing, but from a completely different perspective. And you know, in Killzone we have this player AI running as well, which is kind of like an AI for the player that knows a lot about what the player is looking at and seeing, and not a lot of departments actually use that information. But I could, having conversation with them, I could find, oh, we have all this stuff that we actually know what the player has seen over the last couple of things. And you know, can we give me a little bit of some information there and pull it into the sounds and use it? But Andrea, too.
I think it's really key to take that further and do it from day one. Like, the only thing that makes this sort of breaking out of this audio bubble and having communication easier is doing it from the very inception of a project. Because then you're not dealing with resources in other departments that are already in set, and it's harder to get that communication going. If you make this a joint, kind of push forward from the very beginning, whether you're in AAA or indie, I think it makes it such more...
I agree with you, but the reality is of a project that you're not going to get these ideas when you're in pre-prod, you know, because at pre-prod the game design is all over the place. They don't know what game they're going to make, right? You don't know what game you're going to make until you're halfway through production usually. So how can you really say at the start of pre-prod to an AI coder, I want to have this, because I don't know what's going to be important for me as a player in sound. So
then it becomes about how do you establish a system in pre-production
that
enables you to be able to harness these things and do these experiments as they come up during the development.
But or if you can't get that, to at least build the relationship with those departments, right?
Yeah.
So if you go,
that's right. It doesn't take anything to develop a relationship in pre-production.
It's
you don't need to know
morning.
What game you're having,
yeah.
you're making.
No,
right? You just need to know what kind of coffee they like.
Identify the people in the code department that have ears. You know, are interested in sound, remember them and continue to talk with them and show them what you're doing. And if you have, and you're in pre-prod and you want to start to build that relationship in code, give them something very simple and clear that you want to do as a first thing. You know, so that the first thing you do collaborate on together is something that is a success. Because if the first thing that you do together is complicated and they have to think about, it's like they have to work on it for a month, then the next time you come, they're going to put you on the bottom of the list, you know, because you start with small ideas is really, really important, I think.
Also, from a technical point of view, if this is something a game programmer has to do, or some physics programmer has to do to make up the sound, as a sound programmer, I have to make it as easy as possible. I mean, really, like, go the extra mile and simplifying it to a point where it's almost ridiculous, right? Just make sure that when you get a request like that, cannot dismiss it as like, well, I know that it's only 5 minutes of work for you, and he knows that it's always only 5 minutes of work for you, so just do it now, right? And
that's
it.
Yeah. I saw you on Facebook right there, you know?
That's right. Let me just stand here behind you while you do it. Is that okay?
I'll breathe over your shoulders.
Sometimes, absolutely.
I have a question in that, like, do you have some recommendations on the theme that you're talking about how to explain to a small production team that you can't tell them all the features that you need in the beginning, because what you're saying is like, because you don't know the game.
Well, I think if a team has done a project already, you should talk to them about how that project went, like how much of your game design from pre-prod actually ended up being the game. And I think most of the time you'll find that there was a core there that was the same,
yes.
But actually in reality so much has changed. And then, well, right, and I need to tap into that final thing.
Yeah.
And maybe that will explain it, but...
I appreciate you saying that today, but confirming that that's okay for sound to iterate at that later stage of production.
Yeah.
Because I always feel like I should have done it. Like I should have known that or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to convince the developers that you need some time to iterate there as well.
When you come to you and ask what kind of features you really need, you have to tell them, I need the feature that you guys are nimble and agile and can move quickly when I need it. Yeah, as you just said, it's sometimes impossible to tell beforehand what they will need.
Yeah.
The requirements change constantly. And it's the trick is to make sure that if those requirements change, you can react on that.
I'm on the startup, like one of our projects we haven't announced yet, right? And I basically told the team, like, I will give you a system so we can get audio working, but we're throwing everything out because I don't know what you're doing. And this is not going to be structured right, it's not really what we need. So this is all temporary. Just, you're going to hook this all up again later. Like, I've set that expectation right off the bat. And they're like, oh, okay, that's cool.
And that, I think that circles right back around to, let's say, pre-production, relationships, trust building, and when the eventuality does come that a feature arises because of a choice gameplay has made, they will be ready to take that walk and have that discussion with you so that you can accomplish the goal to provide that supporting role that audio is when it's done right.
Everything else gets reconsidered when the feature goes in.
Yeah.
So it's like audio is part of it.
Yeah.
We've summoned the spirit of collaboration and he has arrived.
Who wants to collaborate on this breakfast?
Yeah, I'm good for that.
No, you can wait.
Oh, jeez. Thank goodness. Now that Rob is here, we can finally get started.
All right, let's start.
Okay. I did a head count. I think we're like 20 people. Isn't this like totally amazing? Thanks so much, guys, for joining us. This is
really
cool.
That means
Syncdance. Oh, Syncdance. Okay.
Syncdance.
Okay.
Okay, well, so it's...
You guys are killing the sink!
Well, listen, it's Thursday, and I'm going to rattle off a couple of the sessions that are going on today, just so that we can throw them out there. There is some amazing stuff today.
And after all those sessions, Gang Awards.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe we should end with that. We'll end with the Gang Awards.
Okay. And this is not all the sessions, these are just the ones that I'm highlighting. We got Oral Immersion, Audio Technology, and Last of Us.
Jonathan Lanier.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is going to be incredible.
Talking about environment.
You got to sleep into the talk, and it's definitely worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you were talking about knowing more about your environment from the physics system.
Yeah.
They've definitely made some progress in new directions from other people with that as well.
Lessons learned from a decade of audio programming.
Who was that from again?
Guy Somberg.
Oh, where was he at?
He is currently at Telltale.
I worked with him very briefly at Flagship Studios when there was a Flagship Studios.
That's
he
right.
He's a smart guy. He was not an audio programmer by training, and he really didn't want to do audio programming, but they had no one else who would do it, and he's kind of like the smartest guy in the room. He said, okay, I'll do it, and he fell in love with it. And he and David Steinwedel had a really awesome working collaboration
exactly.
Together. And he had the opportunity with the studio's trust to basically redo their entire audio engine mid-project. You know, and their only sort of acting rule to him at the time was don't break it. You know, as long as we can hear stuff at the end of the day, when you say you're done, then do whatever you want.
Yeah.
And he went crazy. It was a lot of fun.
It'll be great to get his perspective on it. It'll be great to hear what he's up to now at Telltale, and I think I can't wait to see what he's doing.
Another talk that people might want to check out is Alistair, lead audio programmer for Grand Theft Auto 5, is going to be giving a talk.
So. Somebody from Rockstar is let out of the door. That's
yes, exactly. And he told me he's on vacation right now. So I've gotten a sneak preview on it. Awesome. So definitely we should all go check that out.
I think that you got to be in that room really early because for me, I'm totally blown away. Somebody at Rockstar is even out here.
Yeah, there's actually a bunch of sound designers here.
Yeah, Joe Cavers is here. Yeah. He's recently hired by them, but you know, he hasn't started yet, so that doesn't really count.
Exactly.
You
know?
He got out before he got in.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But he was at Rocksteady, which is also pretty notorious for, you know, closed doors.
Yeah. Rocksteady. I'm just making that connection right now. Is there?
The next studio is going to a Sturtle Rock, he said.
Yeah,
so.
Still a rock.
Yeah.
I think the only shame is that there's going to be two talks at the same time from The Last of Us, one about the audio immersion and the other one about the dialogue system.
Yeah. Yeah, why two Lost of Us talks at the same time?
And the programming and the Grand Theft Audio are overlapping too.
Yeah. Grand Theft Audio.
Nice.
Grand Theft
Nice.
That was a great Freudian slip.
That
would have been a great name for the talk, actually. Yeah. Grand Theft Audio.
It's going to be the name of this episode of the podcast now.
All right.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent.
I get a cut of the proceeds, right?
Royalty payments.
You get the share of all the revenue, and you get the share in paying for all the bandwidth and all that stuff. And
just take it out of my.
Wait, and there's no.
This
revenue,
is not the will that you
want to
take.
Yeah.
There's no revenue. Let's be clear. So then you'll just have to pay us.
Yeah.
Right.
That's how that's gonna work.
You get to buy all of us coffee right now. Thanks for offering.
There's a cool panel today that's called the iSig 20th Anniversary Legends of Game Audio Panel, which is kind of cool. So, I mean, this is a little bit of like acknowledging the past, right? And you've got Michael Sweet, Guy Whitmore, Clint Bajakian, and Brian Schmidt. I mean, all probably waxing philosophical about the glory days of, you know, crunching WAV files down to 8K and, you know, trimming off high frequencies so that when it was compressed that far, it didn't get turned into total mushy soup. And I think that should be a really interesting one. Also, Peggle 2, music system.
Guy Whitmore.
I'll say it again.
Who's working on that?
Okay. But a little investment in that. And I tell you, Guy Whitmore has crafted a pretty cool system for that. And knowing a little bit about it, maybe, I think it's like the Killer Instinct talk. If my understanding of that is, the music system was very dynamic and composed for the system. Peggle 2, in a similar fashion, mirrors that in its tight integration with the game. So. That'll also be a cool talk today.
Cool. Yeah. So, let's see. What else? Blah 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 blah.
Bridging the gap between the audio engine and your game, from Sean LaRish. Again, you know, I love the scope of technical talks this year at GDC. I feel like there are times when GDC feels like it is. Not as technical as something like an AES conference or a develop conference that is focused. And this year is proving that totally wrong. So I'm looking forward to that.
So anybody else for a talk today?
There's the sound of South Park.
Oh, yeah.
Sweet! Yeah. Justin Bell talking about that. Yeah.
What time is that?
That's at 6 hours.
Okay.
Yeah, collaboration. Again.
Here it is.
Of course, also outside of audio, there's going to be a talk on the general technology of Killzone Shadowfall. So I got to plug Michal, the lead on Andreas' team.
Yeah. If you're interested in any kind of rendering technology or just like to look at pretty pictures, he has them all. I think that's going to be some interesting captures in the game, actually, that really show how things work. So
yeah.
I haven't seen it myself yet, briefly.
But Michal gives great presentations. Yeah. And I feel like the rendering pipeline is like our pride and joy really when it comes to our company, right? That's where we shine the most, I would say.
Yeah.
Outside of sound. Sound being number one, rendering technology being number two.
Yeah, that was just a given.
The sound is already number one, so
yeah,
you can't.
Yeah. Oh, way to make me feel bad, Andreas.
You know, audio is rendering.
But I think like in general, you know, Killzone is definitely known for pushing boundaries when it comes to graphics. So whenever somebody's pushing boundaries in anything, it's probably worthwhile to see how they got there, even though maybe technically it's not going to be that the most interesting for most sound people. But you know, Michal's a pretty good speaker, so I gotta plug him too.
Excellent.
And then after that, at 7:30
tonight,
it's gonna be very exciting.
Gang Awards.
First time I'm up for any awards, but we're up for this thing right here.
The podcast is actually up for a Gang Award this year.
Yeah, for sure.
That's right.
We do all win.
Everybody should go. We're all.
Exactly. Yeah.
What if today's episode is so bad?
The voting is already closed. So, you know, this is outside of competition.
So they can't redact it at this point.
Yeah. Right. Well, they might, you know, they might do like Lance Armstrong and take it away from us afterwards, but, you know. Exactly.
We've all been doping.
Yeah. Well, and the great
we're
thing
doping
is,
on this coffee, that's why, you know.
Yeah. It's just, again, I think to be recognized as part of the community, and certainly we've always felt that way, it's nice to be recognized. And what I hope as well is that it brings a new audience to the podcast, because something that we hope for it and have always hoped for it is that it continues to spread and grow like a virus, to continue the discussions that happen at GDC, and that you know, we continue to think about these things not just once a year when we're all here and drinking mad coffee all the time, but as we go back to our studios, to our caves and our development teams, that we can continue to resonate these conversations throughout the year. So, super excited for that. And you know, there's a ton of great people nominated in our same category, and so
you're up for an article in the same category as well.
There's that too.
That wins, I'm definitely gonna kill you.
Maybe you should accept the award for me then.
No.
Just take me out on the way up.
I'll just trip you over.
Fine.
It's like,
You'll die on the wall.
Yeah. It's gonna sound great.
Yeah. But just
Hedge your hats.
Last of Us is gonna reap them. That's my, you know.
That's a good prediction. Anyone?
I would not bet against that.
No. Battlefield 4 for Mix, maybe. That has a good chance. Bioshock for Music, maybe. But the rest is all for Last of Us.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll see tomorrow morning at the podcast. I hope to see you all there again. Enjoy Thursday. Go to the Game Awards. See you tomorrow.
Thanks, guys. See you tomorrow.